enslavement, hinting darkly that Japan would pay, sooner or later, for what it had done to his country. The joke went that everyone gained 5 pounds in baking glass. I could see what they meant. It was held in the morning when everyone was starving, and after a few hours of hard labor, hefting heavy sacks of flour, balling and kneading dough, loading giant deck and windmill ovens with cinnamon buns, croissants, bread and rolls for the various school-operated dining rooms, the room would fill with the smell. When the finished product started coming out of the ovens, the students would fall on it, slathering the still-hot bread and buns with gobs of butter, tearing it apart and shoveling it in their faces. Brownies, pecan diamonds, cookies, profiteroles. Around 10% of the stuff disappeared into our faces and our knife rolls before it was loaded into proof racks and packed off to its final destinations. It was not a pretty sight. All these pale, gangly, pimpled youths in a frenzy of hunger and sexual frustration, shredding bread. It was like Night of the Living Dead. Everyone seemed always to be chewing. If there was an ultimate terror, a man who fit all of our ideas of a real chef, a monstrous, despotic, iron-fisted Frenchman who ruled his kitchen like President for Life Idi Amin, it was Chef Bernard. The final class before graduation was the dreaded yet yearned-for E-Room, the Escoffier Room, an open-to-the-public, 3-star restaurant operated for profit by the school. Diners, it was said, made reservations years in advance. Here, classic French food was served à la carte, finished and served off guéridon by amusingly inept students. Our skipper, the mighty septuagenarian, Chef Bernard, had, it was rumored, actually worked with Escoffier himself. His name was mentioned only in whispers. Students were aware of his unseen presence for months before entering his kitchen. "Wait till E-Room," went the ominous refrain. "Bernard's going to have your ass for breakfast." Needless to say, the pressure, the fear, and the anticipation in the weeks before Escoffier Room were palpable. It was an open kitchen. A large window allowed customers to watch the fearsome chef as he lined up his charges for inspection, assigned the day's workstations, reviewed the crimes and horrors and disappointments of the previous night's efforts. This was a terrifying moment, as we all dreaded the souffle station, the one station where one was assured of drawing the full weight of Chef Bernard's wrath and displeasure. The likelihood of a screw-up was highest here, too. It was certain that at least one of your à la minute souffles would, under real working conditions, fail to rise, rise unevenly, collapse in on itself, in some way fail to meet our leader's exacting standards. Students would actually tremble with fear before line-up and work assignments, praying, "Not me, Lord, not today, please, not the souffle station." If you screwed up, you'd get what was called the 10 minutes. In full view of the gawking public and quavering comrades, the offending souffle cook would be called forward to stand at attention, while the intimidating old French master would look down his Gallic schnoz and unload the most withering barrage of scorn any of us had ever experienced. "You are a shit chef," he would bellow. "I make two cook like you in the toilette each morning. You are disgusting, a shoemaker. You have destroyed my life. You will never be a chef. You are a disgrace. Look, look at this mailed, mailed, mailed." At this point, Bernard would stick his fingers into the offending object and fling bits of it on the floor. "You dare call this cuisine? This is grotesque, an abomination. You should kill yourself from shame." I had to hand it to the old bastard, though. He was fair. Everyone got 10 minutes, even the girls who would, sad to say, invariably burst into tears 30 seconds into the chef's tirade. He did not let their tears or sobs deter him. They stood there, shaking and heaving for the full time, while he ranted and raved and cursed heaven and earth and their ancestors and their future progeny, breaking them down like everybody else, until all that remained was a trembling little bundle of nerves with an unnaturally red face in a white polyester uniform. One notable victim of Chef Bernard's reign of terror was a buddy of mine, also much older than the other students, who had just returned from Vietnam. He'd served in combat with an artillery unit and returned stateside to attend the CIA under the GI Bill, and had made it through the whole program, had only 4 days to go before graduation. But when he saw that in a day or two his number would be up and he, without question, would be working the dreaded souffle station, he folded under the pressure. He went AWOL, disappearing from Hyde Park forever. Boot camp and the Viet Cong had not been as bad as Chef Bernard's 10 minutes, I guess. When my time came to stand there in front of my fellow students and all the world and get my 10 minutes, I was ready. I could see Chef Bernard looking deep into my eyes as he began his standard tirade, could see him recognize a glimmer of something familiar somewhere in there. I did the convict thing. The louder and more confrontational the authority figure got, the more dreamy and relaxed I became. Bernard saw it happening. I may have been standing at rigid attention and saying all the right things, "We chef, no chef," at all the right moments, and showing the right respect, but he could see, perhaps in my dead fish-eye gaze, that he wasn't getting anywhere with me. I think the old bastard might have even smiled a little bit halfway through. There seemed to be a twinkle of amusement in his eyes as he finally dismissed me with feigned disgust. He knew, I think, that I had already been humiliated. He looked in my eyes and saw perhaps that Tyrone and the Mario crew had done his work for him. I liked Chef Bernard and respected him. I enjoyed working under him. But the fat bastard didn't scare me, and he knew it. He could have smacked me upside the head with a skillet, and I would have smiled at him through broken teeth. He saw that, I think, and it ruined all the fun. He was actually nice to me after that. He let me stand and watch him decorate the voiture each night, a task he reserved for himself, the glazing and garnishing of a hot roast and a rolling silver display cart. He layered on his blanched leeks and carved tomato roses like a brain surgeon humming quietly to himself, aware, I think, that soon they wouldn't be doing much of this anymore. My final proud accomplishment at CIA was the torpedoing of a dangerous folly being planned for the graduation ceremonies. The event was planned for the Great Hall, the former chapel in the main building. An idea was being floated by some of my classmates, all overzealous would-be pastry chefs, to create a display of pastillage, marzipan, chocolate sculpture, and wedding cakes to wow and amaze our loved ones as they were herded into the ceremony. I'd seen the kind of work an overeager pâtissier can do. I'd seen their instructor's work, and most of it was awful, as so much pastry and garde-manger work is when the chef starts thinking he's an artist rather than a craftsman. I'd seen a much-admired commemorative cake depicting Nixon, painted in chocolate on a pastillage cameo, communicating by telephone with the Apollo astronauts in their space module, also chocolate on pastillage. I did not want my friends and family to have to gaze upon a horror like that. I didn't want to be a killjoy. To dampen the enthusiasm at this proud and happy event by being a naysayer and a cynic was too close to what I'd been at Vassar, and those days, I like to think, were behind me. I was sneakier in my strategy to put an end to this outrage. I submitted my own earnest proposal, requesting that I be allowed to contribute a pièce montée to the festivities, even going so far as to submit a sketch of my proposed project. It would be a life-size tallow sculpture depicting a white-toqued baby Jesus with knife and steel in his tiny hands, held by an adoring Madonna. Needless to say, my beef-fat Madonna horrified the graduation committee. Rather than offend my disturbingly sincere, if quirky, religious beliefs, they scotched the whole display. An animal fat Sistine Chapel was not something they wanted all those parents and dignitaries to see. And who knows what could happen if they opened the door for me? What other demented expressions of personal hell might wind up lining the Great Hall? The ensuing ceremony was thus spared the prospect of decomposing aspects depicting Moses parting the Red Sea or melting wedding cakes. A few days later, I had my diploma. I was now a graduate of the best cooking school in the country, a valuable commodity in the open market. I had field experience, a vocabulary, and a criminal mind. I was a danger to myself and others. The Return of Malcarne. My triumphant return to Provincetown, halfway through the program at CIA, came the following summer. Newly invigorated with obscure cooking terms, the professional chef and the Larousse Gastronomique under my arm, and my head filled with half-baked ideas and a few techniques I'd seen and maybe even tried a few times, I rejoined my old comrades at the Dreadnought, to much curiosity and amusement. A little knowledge can be dangerous and annoying, but I'd actually learned some useful things. I'd been working in the city weekends while at school. I could work a station without embarrassing myself, and I was enthusiastic about my new, if modest, skills. I was determined to outwork, outlast, and in every way impress my old tormentors at Mario's. Dimitri, the pasta man, was years older than I was. Then in his early 30s, running to fat with chunky frame glasses and a well-tended handlebar mustache, he was markedly different from his fellow cooks at Mario's. Born in the USA of a Russian father and a German mother, he was the only other cook in P-Town who'd been to cooking school. In his case, a hotel school in Switzerland. Though he claimed to have been expelled for demonstrating the twist in that institution's dining hall, I always doubted this version of events. He became the second great influence in my career. A mama's boy, loner, intellectual, voracious reader, and gourmand, Dimitri was a man of esoteric skills and appetites. A gambler, philosopher, gardener, fly fisherman, fluent in Russian and German, as well as having an amazing command of English. He loved antiquated phrases, dry sarcasm, military jargon, regional dialect, and the New York Times crossword puzzle, to which he was hopelessly addicted. It was from Dimitri's fertile mind that much of what I'd come to know as Mario speak had originated. Brainy, paranoid, famously prone to sulking, he both amused and appalled his co-workers with his many misadventures, his affected mannerisms, and his tendency to encounter tragicomic disaster. Fond of hyperbole and dramatic overstatement, Dmitri had distinguished himself after a particularly unpleasant breakup with a girlfriend by shaving his head completely bald. This would have been in itself a rather bold statement of self-loathing and grief, but Dmitri pushed matters to the extreme. The story went that he had no sooner revealed his snow-white skull to the world than he went to the beach, got drunk, and sat there roasting his never-before-exposed-to-the-sun scalp to the July ultraviolets. When he returned to work the next day, not only was he jarringly bald, but his head was a bright strawberry-red, blistered and oozing skullcap of misery. No one talked to him until his hair grew back. Dmitri saw himself, I think, as a Hemingway-esque, hard-boozing, raconteur, Renaissance man. But he was completely under the thumb of his mother, a severe, equally brilliant gynecologist, whose daily calls to the Mario kitchen were much imitated. "Allô, is Dmitri there?" We'd met before, of course, the previous year, when he'd known me, no doubt, as Mel. But I was a broiler man now, a CIA student, a curiosity. It was permissible for Dmitri to talk to me. It was like Hunt and Liddy meeting. The world would probably have been a better place had it never happened, but a lot of fun was had by all. Dmitri was scared of the outside world. He lived year-round at the tip of the Cape, and he liked to fancy himself a townie. He did a damn good imitation of a local Portuguese fisherman accent, too. But Dmitri was, as the Brits say, quite the other thing. We'd have drinks after knocking off at our respective restaurants and try to outdo each other with arcane bits of food knowledge and terminology. Dmitri, like me, was a born snob, so it was only natural that when our lord and master Mario decided on 2 employees to cater his annual garden party, he selected his 2 would-be escoffiers, the Dmitri and Tony show. Our early efforts were, in the cold light of day, pretty crude and laughable. But nobody else in town was doing pâté en croûte or galantine en aspic or elaborate chauffeur presentations. Mario tasked his most pretentious cooks with an important mission, and we were determined not to let him down, especially as it allowed us time off from our regular kitchen chores and all the overtime we needed. We threw ourselves into the task with near fanatical once-in-a-lifetime zeal and prodigious amounts of cocaine and amphetamines. As a fly fisherman, Dmitri made his own lures. This obsessive eye for detail carried over to his food. For Mario's garden party, we spent days together in a walk-in refrigerator, heads filled with accelerants, gluing near-microscopic bits of carved and blanched vegetables onto the sides of roast and poached fishes and fowls with hot aspic. We must have looked like crazed neurologists, using tweezers, bamboo skewers, and bar straws to cut and affix garnishes, laboring straight through the night. Covered with gelée, sleepless after 48 hours in the cooler, we lost all perspective. Dmitri at one point obsessing over a tiny red faux mushroom in one corner of a poached salmon, muttering to himself about the distinctive white dots on the hood of the Amanita muscara or psilocybin mushroom, while he applied dust-sized motes of cooked egg white for authenticity. He buried all sorts of horticultural in-jokes in his work, already insanely detailed gardens of Eden made of leek strips, chives, scallions, paper-thin slices of carrots and peppers. He created jungle tableau on the sides of hams that he considered reminiscent of Rousseau's better efforts, or Gauguin-like. When I jokingly suggested Moses parting the Red Sea on the side of a striped bass, Dmitri got a faraway look on his face and immediately suggested a plan. "The Israelites in the foreground, we can use straws to cut the olive and egg whites for their eyes, but the Egyptians pursuing in the background, we can cut their eyes with bar straws, you know, the zipsticks, so they're smaller, you see, for perspective." I had to physically restrain him from attempting this tableau. We had been under refrigeration for 3 days straight when we finally collapsed in the Dreadnought's cocktail lounge at 4 a.m., unshaven, dirty, and crazed. We woke up a few hours later covered with flies, attracted by the tasty, protein-rich gelée that covered us from head to toe. The garden party was, to be modest, a smashing success. No one in dowdy old Provincetown had ever seen anything like it. We became instantly notorious, and we made the most of it, printing up business cards for a planned catering venture called Moonlight Menus. The cards, commissioned from a local artist, depicted us sneering in toques. We proceeded to hand these things out to local businessmen, telling them blithely that not only did we not need or even want their business, but they couldn't possibly afford us, as we were easily the most expensive and exclusive caterers on the entire Cape. 2 highly trained specimens like us had more than enough business, thank you very much. There was, of course, no business. But the strategy worked. In the coke-soaked final weeks of 1975 P-Town, there were plenty of local businessmen eager to impress their friends with an elaborate end-of-season bash. And we were only too happy to encourage them in even grander pretensions, filling their heads with names and dishes we'd culled from my Larousse, few of which we'd actually attempted, and quoting staggering prices. We knew well how much these people were paying for cocaine, and that the more coke cost, the more people wanted it. We applied the same marketing plan to our budding catering operation, along with a similar pricing structure, and business was suddenly very, very good. In no time, we were able to leave our regular jobs at the Dreadnought and Mario's, lording it over our old co-workers in brand-new Tony Lama boots and brandishing shiny new Wusthof knives when we dropped by for a quick visit and a gloat. Our customers were restaurateurs, coke dealers, guys who ran fast boats out to motherships off Hyannis and Barnstable to offload bales of marijuana. We catered weddings, parties, private dinners for pizza magnates, successful leather and scrimshaw merchants. All the while, I filled Dimitri's head with the idea that what we were doing here, we could do back in New York, only bigger and better. Ah, those heady days of happy delusion, spirited argument, grandiose dreams of glory and riches. We did not aspire to be the new Bocuses. No, that wasn't enough. Jacked up on coke and vodka, we wanted nothing less than to be like Carême, whose enormous Piedmonte married the concepts of architecture and food. Our work would literally tower over the work of our contemporaries. Space needles, towers of Babel, Parthenons of forcemeat stuffed pastry, carefully constructed new Babylons of barquettes, vol-au-vent, croque-en-bouche. The very words excited and challenged us to reach higher and higher. We had some successes and some failures. A steamship round, a whole roast leg of beef on the bone, sounded like a good idea. It was, after all, big. Until we overcooked it. An all-Chinese meal we did was so overloaded with dried Szechuan peppers that we could hear the muffled wails of pain from the next room. And I recall with horror a blue wedding cake, layers of turquoise-colored buttercream and sponge cake decorated with fruit that looked more like Siegfried and Roy's beach house than anything Carême ever did. But we did have some notable successes as well. Provincetown's first crown roast of veal with mushroom duxelle stuffing and black truffle-studded Madeira sauce for one, and our mighty Colosseum of Seafood Blanquette. The client was a restaurant owner, and we oversold ourselves somewhat. Committed to our pastry terror dome, we soon found that there wasn't a mold quite large enough for this ambitious effort. What we wanted was a tasty yet structurally sound Colosseum of pastry crust into which we could pour about 5 gallons of seafood stew. And we wanted the whole thing to be covered by a titanic pastry dome, perhaps with a tiny pastry figure from antiquity like Ajax or Mercury perched on top. We didn't know if the thing could be done. Other than old engravings from Larousse, we'd never seen anything like what we were attempting. There was no suitable springform mold, something we could line with foil and fill with beans and then blind bake. We couldn't cook it together with the blanquette. It would never hold. The bubbling veloute suspending our medley of fish and shellfish and wild mushrooms would make the walls too soft. And the dough, what crust could support the weight of 5 gallons of molten stew? As game time approached, we were getting worried. We set up our operations center in our client's restaurant kitchen and promptly bivouacked to a bar for some serious strategizing. In the end, as it so often does, it came down to Julia. Julia Child's recipes have little snob appeal, but they also tend to work. We took a recipe for dough from her book on French cooking, and after rubbing the outside of a large lobster steamer with shortening, stretched and patched our dough around and over it. It was exactly the opposite of the prevailing wisdom. Fortunately, we didn't know that at the time. For our dome, we used the top of the pot and the same principle, laying our dough over the outside of the round lid and baking it until firm. When we finally slid the things off, very carefully, I can tell you, Dimitri was characteristically pessimistic. Would it hold? He didn't think so. It was a lot of stew we were planning on pouring into this thing, and Dimitri was convinced it would crumble at the table mid-meal, boiling hot fish and lava-like veloute rushing onto the laps of the terrified guests. There would be terrible burns involved, he guessed. Scarring, lawsuits, total disgrace. Dimitri cheered himself up by suggesting that should the unthinkable happen, we were obliged, like Japanese naval officers, to take our own lives. Or like Vatel, he submitted. He ran himself on his sword over late fish delivery. It's the least we could do. In the end, we agreed that should our Colosseum of Seafood Blanquette fall, we'd simply walk quietly out the door and into the bay to drown ourselves. Party time came, and we were ready, we hoped. First there were hors d'oeuvres, microscopic canapés of smoked salmon, cucumber, and caviar, Dimitri's chicken liver mousse with diced aspic, little barquettes of something or other, deviled eggs with fish roe, a lovely pâté en croûte with center garnishes of tongue, ham, pistachio, and black truffles, and an accompanying sauce Cumberland I'd lifted right out of my CIA textbook. Our crown roast was no problem. It was the blanquette that filled our hearts with dread and terror. But God protects fools and drunks, and we were certainly both foolish and drunk much of the time. Things went brilliantly. Our Colosseum's walls held. The crown roast, decorated with little frilly panties on each gracefully outward-arching rib bone, looked and tasted sensational. We were given a standing ovation by the dazzled guests and grateful client. When we next showed up at our old kitchens for our weekly gloat, our heads were too big to fit in P-Town's doors. We were already planning on hunting bigger game. We had newer, more sophisticated, even richer victims in mind for our learn-as-we-go operation in New York. Who cooks? Who's cooking your food anyway? What strange beasts lurk behind the kitchen doors? You see the chef. He's the guy without the hat, with the clipboard under his arm. Maybe his name stitched in Tuscan blue on his starched white chef's coat next to those cotton Chinese buttons. But who's actually cooking your food? Are they young, ambitious culinary school grads putting in their time on the line until they get their shot at the big job? Probably not. If the chef is anything like me, the cooks are a dysfunctional mercenary lot, fringe dwellers motivated by money, the peculiar lifestyle of cooking, and a grim pride. They're probably not even American. Line cooking done well is a beautiful thing to watch. It's a high-speed collaboration resembling, at its best, ballet or modern dance. A properly organized, fully loaded line cook, one who works clean and has moves, meaning economy of movement, nice technique, and most important, speed, can perform his duties with Nijinsky-like grace. The job requires character and endurance. A good line cook never shows up late, never calls in sick, and works through pain and injury. What most people don't get about professional-level cooking is that it is not at all about the best recipe, the most innovative presentation, the most creative marriage of ingredients, flavors, and textures. That, presumably, was all arranged long before you sat down to dinner. Line cooking, the real business of preparing the food you eat, is more about consistency, about mindless, unvarying repetition, the same series of tasks performed over and over and over again in exactly the same way. The last thing a chef wants in a line cook is an innovator, somebody with ideas of his own who is going to mess around with the chef's recipes and presentations. Chefs require blind, near-fanatical loyalty, a strong back, and an automaton-like consistency of execution under battlefield conditions. A 3-star Italian chef pal of mine was recently talking about why he, a proud Tuscan who makes his own pasta and sauces from scratch daily and runs one of the best restaurant kitchens in New York, would never be so foolish as to hire any Italians to cook on his line. He greatly prefers Ecuadorians, as many chefs do. The Italian guy, you're screaming at him in the rush. Where's that risotto? Is that fucking risotto ready yet? Give me that risotto. And the Italian, he's going to give it to you. An Ecuadorian guy, he's just going to turn his back and stir the risotto and keep cooking it until it's done the way you showed him. That's what I want. I knew just what he meant. Generally speaking, American cooks, meaning born in the USA, possibly school-trained, culinarily sophisticated types, who know before you show them what Monte au beurre means and how to make a béarnaise sauce, are a lazy, undisciplined, and worst of all, high-maintenance lot. Annoyingly opinionated, possessed of egos requiring constant stroking and tune-ups, and as members of a privileged and wealthy population, unused to the kind of disrespect a busy chef is inclined to dish out. No one understands and appreciates the American dream of hard work leading to material rewards better than a non-American. The Ecuadorian, Mexican, Dominican, and Salvadoran cooks I've worked with over the years make most CIA-educated white boys look like clumsy, sniveling little punks. In New York City, the days of the downtrodden, underpaid, illegal immigrant cook exploited by his cruel masters have largely passed, at least where quality line cooks are concerned. Most of the Ecuadorians and Mexicans I hire from a large pool, a sort of farm team of associated and often related former dishwashers, are very well-paid professionals, much sought after by other chefs. Chances are they've worked their way up from the bottom rung. They remember well what it was like to empty out grease traps, scrape plates, haul leaking bags of garbage out to the curb at 4 a.m. A guy who's come up through the ranks, who knows every station, every recipe, every corner of the restaurant, and who has learned, first and foremost, your system above all others, is likely to be more valuable and long-term than some bedwetting white boy whose mom brought him up to think the world owed him a living, and who thinks he actually knows a few things. You want loyalty from your line cooks. Somebody who wakes up with a scratchy throat and slight fever and thinks it's okay to call in sick is not what I'm looking for. While it's necessary for cooks to take pride in their work, it's a good idea to let a good cook stretch a little now and again with the occasional contribution of a special or a soup. This is still the army. Ultimately, I want a salute and a yes, sir. If I want an opinion from my line cooks, I'll provide one. Your customers arrive expecting the same dish prepared the same way they had it before. They don't want some budding Wolfgang Puck having fun with kiwis and coriander with a menu item they've come to love. There are plenty of exceptions, of course. I have a few Americans in my traveling roadshow, a few key people whom I tend to hire over and over as I move from place to place. The relationship between a chef and sous chef can be a particularly intimate one, for instance, and it's nice to have someone with a similar background and worldview when you're going to spend almost every waking hour together. Women line cooks, however rare they might be in the testosterone-heavy, male-dominated world of restaurant kitchens, are a particular delight. To have a tough-as-nails, foul-mouthed, trash-talking female line cook on your team can be a true joy, and a civilizing factor in a unit where conversation tends to center around who's got the bigger balls and who takes it in the ass. I've been fortunate enough to work with some really studly women line cooks. No weak reads these. One woman, Sharon, managed to hold down a busy sauté station while 7 months pregnant and still find time to provide advice and comfort to a romantically unhappy broiler man. A longtime associate, Beth, who likes to refer to herself as the grill bitch, excelled at putting loudmouths and fools into their proper place. She refused to behave any differently than her male co-workers. She'd change in the same locker area, dropping her pants right alongside them. She was as sexually aggressive and as vocal about it as her fellow cooks, but unlikely to suffer behavior she found demeaning. One sorry Moroccan cook who pinched her ass found himself suddenly bent over a cutting board with Beth dry-humping him from behind, saying, "How do you like it, bitch?" The guy almost died of shame and never repeated that mistake again. Another female line cook I had the pleasure of working with arrived at work one morning to find that an Ecuadorian pasta cook had decorated her station with some particularly ugly hardcore pornography of pimply-assed women getting penetrated in every orifice by pot-bellied guys with prison tattoos and back hair. She didn't react at all, but a little later, while passing through the pasta man's station, casually remarked, "Jose, I see you brought in some photos of the family. Mom looks good for her age." Mise en place is the religion of all good line cooks. Do not fuck with a line cook's mise, meaning their setup, their carefully arranged supplies of sea salt, rough cracked pepper, softened butter, cooking oil, wine, backups, and so on. As a cook, your station and its condition, its state of readiness, is an extension of your nervous system, and it is profoundly upsetting if another cook, or God forbid, a waiter, disturbs your precisely and carefully laid out system. The universe is in order when your station is set up the way you like it. You know where to find everything with your eyes closed. Everything you need during the course of the shift is at the ready, at arm's reach. Your defenses are deployed. If you let your mise en place run down, get dirty and disorganized, you'll quickly find yourself spinning in place and calling for backup. I worked with a chef who used to step behind the line to a dirty cook station in the middle of the rush to explain why the offending cook was falling behind. He'd press his palm down on the cutting board, which was littered with peppercorns, spattered sauce, bits of parsley, breadcrumbs, and the usual flotsam and jetsam that accumulates quickly on a station, if not constantly wiped away with a moist side towel. "You see this?" he'd inquire, raising his palm so that the cook could see the bits of dirt and scraps sticking to his chef's palm. "That's what the inside of your head looks like now. Work clean." Working clean, constantly wiping and cleaning, is a desirable state of affairs for the conscientious line cook. That chef was right. Messy station equals messy mind. This explains why side towels are hoarded like gold by good line cooks. When the linen order arrives, the smart cookies fall onto it voraciously, stashing stacks of the valuable objects anywhere they can hide them. One cook I knew would load them above the acoustic tile in the ceiling above his station, along with his favorite tongs, favorite nonstick pans, slotted spoons, and anything else he figured he needed on his station and didn't want another cook to get. I'm sure that years later, though that restaurant has changed hands many times since, future generations of cooks are still finding stashes of fluffy, clean side towels. It's not just clean that you value in a side towel, it's dry. It's nice wiping the rim of a plate with a slightly moist one, but try grabbing a red-hot sauté pan handle with a wet towel, and you'll learn fast why a fresh stack of dry towels is a necessity. Some traditional European kitchens still issue 2 towels per cook at the beginning of the shift, one to work with while the other dries on the oven handle. This strikes me as criminally parsimonious. I like a tall stack conveniently located over my station in neatly folded, kitty-cornered, easy-to-grab fashion, and I don't ever want to run out. I'll rip through 20 of them in the course of an 8-hour service period, and if it costs my masters a few bucks extra, tough. I'm not burning my hand or wiping grease on my nice plates because they're too mean to shell out for a few more rented towels. What exactly is this mystical mise en place I keep going on about? Why are some line cooks driven to apoplexy at the pinching of even a few grains of salt, a pinch of parsley? Because it's ours. Because we set it up the way we want it. Because it's like our knives, about which you hear the comment, "Don't touch my dick, don't touch my knife." A fairly standard mise en place is a pretty extensive list. A typical one would be composed of, for instance, kosher or sea salt, crushed black peppercorns, hand-crushed, not ground in the blender, ground white pepper, fresh breadcrumbs, chiffonade parsley, blended oil in wine bottle with speed pourer, extra virgin olive oil, white wine, brandy, chervil tops in ice water for garnish, chive sticks or chopped chives, tomato concassé, caramelized apple sections, garlic confit, chopped or slivered garlic, chopped shallots, softened butter, favorite ladles, spoons, tongs, pans, pots, all sauces, portioned fish, meat, menu items, specials, and backups conveniently positioned for easy access. Being set up properly, trained and coordinated is not nearly enough. A good line cook has to be able to remain clear-headed, organized, and reasonably even-keeled during hectic and stressful service periods. When you've got 30 or 40 more tables, all sitting down at the same time and ordering different items with different temperatures, the stuff has to come up together. The various stations, sauté, garde-manger, broiler, middle, have to assemble a party attends dinner at the same moment. You can't have one member of a party's Dover sole festering in the window by the sauté station while the grill guy waits for a rack of lamb to hit medium rare. It's got to come up together. Your hero line cook doesn't let the screaming, the frantic cries of is it ready yet, the long and potentially confusing list of donenesses all working at the same time throw him. He's got to keep all those temperatures straight in his head, remembering which steak goes with what. He's got to be able to tune out the howls of outrage from the chef, the tiny gibbering annoyances from the floor, the curses and questions and prompts from his co-workers. Ready on seven? Via, let's go. Vamos, coming up on seven. The ability to work well with others is a must. If you're a sauté man, your grill man is your dance partner, and chances are you're spending the majority of your time working in a hot, uncomfortably confined, submarine-like space with him. You're both working around open flame, boiling liquids with plenty of blunt objects at close hand, and you both carry knives, lots of knives, so you had better get along. It will not do to have two heavily armed cooks duking it out behind the line over some perceived insult when there are vats of boiling grease and razor-sharp cutlery all around. So who the hell exactly are these guys, the boys and girls in the trenches? You might get the impression from the specifics of my less-than-stellar career that all line cooks are whacked-out, moral degenerates, dope fiends, refugees, a thuggish assortment of drunks, sneak thieves, sluts, and psychopaths. You wouldn't be too far off base. The business, as respected three-star chef Scott Bryan explains it, attracts fringe elements, people for whom something in their lives has gone terribly wrong. Maybe they didn't make it through high school. Maybe they're running away from something, be it an ex-wife, a rotten family history, trouble with the law, a squalid third-world backwater with no opportunity for advancement. Or maybe, like me, they just like it here. They're comfortable with a rather relaxed and informal code of conduct in the kitchen, the elevated level of tolerance for eccentricity, unseemly personal habits, lack of documentation, prison experience. In most kitchens, one's freakish personal proclivities matter little, if at all. Can you keep up? Are you ready for service? Can I count on you to show up at work tomorrow to not let the side down? That's what counts. I can break down line cooks into three subgroups. You've got your artists, the annoying, high-maintenance minority. This group includes specialists like pâtissiers, the neurologists of cooking, sous-chefs, butchers, garde-manger psychos, the occasional saucier whose sauces are so ethereal and perfect that delusions of grandeur are tolerated. Then there are the exiles, people who just can't make it in any other business, could never survive a 9-to-5 job, wear a tie, or blend in with civilized society, and their comrades, the refugees, usually emigres and immigrants for whom cooking is preferable to death squads, poverty, or working in a sneaker factory for $2 a week. Finally, there are the mercenaries, people who do it for cash and do it well. Cooks who, though they have little love or natural proclivity for cuisine, do it at a high level because they are paid well to do it, and because they are professionals. Cooking is a craft, I like to think, and a good cook is a craftsman, not an artist. There's nothing wrong with that. The great cathedrals of Europe were built by craftsmen. They're not designed by them. Practicing your craft in expert fashion is noble, honorable, and satisfying. And I'll generally take a stand-up mercenary who takes pride in his professionalism over an artist any day. When I hear artist, I think of someone who doesn't think it necessary to show up at work on time. More often than not, their efforts, convinced as they are of their own genius, are geared more to giving themselves a hard-on than satisfying the great majority of dinner customers. Personally, I prefer to eat food that tastes good and is an honest reflection of its ingredients than a 3-foot-tall caprice constructed from lemongrass, lawn trimmings, coconuts, and red curry. you could lose an eye trying to eat that. When a job applicant starts telling me how Pacific Rim job cuisine turns him on and inspires him, I see trouble coming. Send me another Mexican dishwasher anytime. I can teach him to cook. I can't teach character. Show up at work on time 6 months in a row, and we'll talk about red curry paste and lemongrass. Until then, I have 4 words for you. Shut the fuck up. From our kitchen to your table. I saw a sign the other day outside one of those Chinese-Japanese hybrids that are beginning to pop up around town, advertising discount sushi. I can't imagine a better example of things to be wary of in the food department than bargain sushi. Yet the place had customers. I wonder, had the sign said cheap sushi or old sushi, if they'd still be eating there. Good food and good eating are about risk. Every once in a while, an oyster, for instance, will make you sick to your stomach. Does this mean you should stop eating oysters? No way. The more exotic the food, the more adventurous the serious eater, the higher the likelihood of later discomfort. I'm not going to deny myself the pleasures of morcilla sausage or sashimi or even ropa vieja at the local Cuban joint, just because sometimes I feel bad a few hours after I've eaten them. But there are some general principles I adhere to, things I've seen over the years that remain in mind and have altered my eating habits. I may be perfectly willing to try the grilled lobster at an open-air barbecue shack in the Caribbean, where the refrigeration is dubious and I can see with my own eyes the flies buzzing around the grill. I mean, how often am I in the Caribbean? I want to make the most of it. But on home turf, with the daily business of eating in restaurants, there are some definite do's and don'ts I've chosen to live by. I never order fish on Monday unless I'm eating at Le Bernardin, a 4-star restaurant where I know they're buying their fish directly from the source. I know how old most seafood is on Monday, about 4 to 5 days old. You walk into a nice 2-star place in Tribeca on a sleepy Monday evening, and you see they're running a delicious-sounding special of yellowfin tuna, braised fennel, confit tomatoes, and a saffron sauce. Why not go for it? Here are the 2 words that should leap out at you when you navigate the menu. Monday and special. Here's how it works. The chef of this fine restaurant orders his fish on Thursday for delivery Friday morning. He's ordering a pretty good amount of it, too, as he's not getting another delivery until Monday morning. All right, some seafood purveyors make Saturday deliveries, but the market is closed Friday night. It's the same fish from Thursday. The chef is hoping to sell the bulk of that fish, your tuna, on Friday and Saturday nights, when he assumes it will be busy. He's assuming also that if he has a little left on Sunday, he can unload the rest of it then, as seafood salad for brunch or as a special. Monday, it's merchandising night, when whatever is left over from the weekend is used up and hopefully sold for money. Terrible, you say? Why doesn't he throw the leftover tuna out? The guy can get deliveries on Monday, right? Sure he can. But what is preventing his seafood purveyor from thinking exactly the same way? The seafood vendor is emptying out his refrigerator, too. But the Fulton Street Fish Market is open on Monday morning, you say. He can get fresh. I've been to the Fulton Street Market at 3 o'clock on Monday morning, friends, and believe me, it does not inspire confidence. Chances are good that the tuna you're thinking of ordering on Monday night has been kicking around in the restaurant's regions, already cut and held, with the mise en place online, commingling with the chicken and the salmon and the lamb chops for 4 days, the region doors swinging open every few seconds as the line cooks plunge their fists in, blindly feeling around for what they need. These are not optimum refrigeration conditions. This is why you don't see a lot of codfish or other perishable items as a Sunday or Monday night special. They're not sturdy enough. The chef knows. He anticipates the likelihood that he might still have some fish lying around on Monday morning, and he'd like to get money for it without poisoning his customers. Seafood is a tricky business. Red snapper may only cost a chef $4.95 a pound, but that price includes the bones, the head, the scales, and all the stuff that gets cut and thrown away. By the time it's cut, the actual cost of each piece of clean fillet costs the chef more than twice that amount, and he'd greatly prefer to sell it than toss it in the garbage. If it still smells okay on Monday night, you're eating it. I don't eat mussels in restaurants unless I know the chef personally or have seen with my own eyes how they store and hold their mussels for service. I love mussels, but in my experience, most cooks are less than scrupulous in their handling of them. More often than not, mussels are allowed to wallow in their own foul-smelling piss in the bottom of a reach-in. Some restaurants, I'm sure, have special containers with convenient slotted bins which allow the mussels to drain while being held. And maybe, just maybe, the cooks at these places pick carefully through every order, mussel by mussel, making sure that everyone is healthy and alive before throwing them into a pot. I haven't worked too many places like that. Mussels are too easy. Line cooks consider mussels a gift. They take 2 minutes to cook, a few seconds to dump in a bowl, and bada-bing, one more customer taken care of. Now they can concentrate on slicing the damn duck breast. I have had, at a very good Paris Brasserie, the misfortune to eat a single bad mussel. One treacherous little guy hidden among an otherwise impeccable group. It slammed me shut like a book, sent me crawling to the bathroom, shitting like a mink, clutching my stomach and projectile vomiting. I prayed that night, for many hours. And as you might assume, I'm the worst kind of atheist. Fortunately, the French have liberal policies on doctors' house calls and affordable health care, but I do not care to repeat that experience. No thank you on the mussels. If I'm hungry for mussels, I'll pick the good-looking ones out of your order. How about seafood on Sunday? Well, sometimes. But never an obvious attempt to offload aging stuff, like seafood salad vinaigrette or seafood frittata on a brunch menu. Brunch menus are an open invitation to the cost-conscious chef, a dumping ground for the odd bits left over from Friday and Saturday nights, or for the scraps generated in the normal course of business. You see a fish that would be much better served by quick grilling with a slice of lemon, suddenly all dressed up with vinaigrette, for en vinaigrette on the menu read preserved or disguised. While we're on brunch, how about hollandaise sauce? Not for me. Bacteria love hollandaise, and hollandaise, that delicate emulsion of egg yolks and clarified butter, must be held at a temperature not too hot nor too cold, lest it break when spooned over your poached eggs. Unfortunately, this lukewarm holding temperature is also the favored environment for bacteria to copulate and reproduce in. Nobody I know has ever made hollandaise to order. Most likely, the stuff on your eggs was made hours ago and held on station. Equally disturbing is the likelihood that the butter used in the hollandaise is melted table butter, heated, clarified, and strained to get out all the breadcrumbs and cigarette butts. Butter is expensive, you know. Hollandaise is a veritable petri dish of biohazards. And how long has that Canadian bacon been festering in the walk-in anyway? Remember, brunch is only served once a week, on weekends. Buzzword here, brunch menu. Translation, old nasty odds and ends at $12 for two eggs with a free Bloody Mary. One other point about brunch. Cooks hate brunch. A wise chef will deploy his best line cooks on Friday and Saturday nights. He'll be reluctant to schedule those same cooks early Sunday morning, especially since they probably went out after work Saturday and got hammered until the wee hours. Worse, brunch is demoralizing to the serious line cook. Nothing makes an aspiring escoffier feel more like an army commissary cook, or Mel from Mel's Diner, than having to slop out eggs over bacon and eggs Benedict for the Sunday brunch crowd. Brunch is punishment block for the B-team cooks, or where the farm team of recent dishwashers learn their chops. Most chefs are off on Sundays, too, so supervision is at a minimum. Consider that before ordering the seafood frittata. I will eat bread in restaurants, even if I know it's probably been recycled off somebody else's table. The reuse of bread is an industry-wide practice. I saw a recent news expose, hidden camera and all, where the anchor was shocked to see unused bread returned to the kitchen and then sent right out back onto the floor. Bullshit. I'm sure that some restaurants explicitly instruct their Bengali busboys to throw out all that unused bread, which amounts to about 50%. And maybe some places actually do it. But when it's busy and the busboy is crumbing tables, emptying ashtrays, refilling water glasses, making espresso and cappuccino, hustling dirty dishes to the dishwasher, and he sees a basket full of untouched bread, most times he's going to use it. This is a fact of life. This doesn't bother me and shouldn't surprise you. Okay, maybe once in a while some tubercular hillbilly has been coughing and spraying in the general direction of that bread basket. Or some tourist who's just returned from a walking tour of the wetlands of West Africa sneezes. You might find that prospect upsetting. But you might just as well avoid air travel or subways, equally dodgy environments for airborne transmission of disease. Eat the bread. I won't eat in a restaurant with filthy bathrooms. This isn't a hard call. They let you see the bathrooms. If the restaurant can't be bothered to replace the puck in the urinal or keep the toilets and floors clean, then just imagine what their refrigeration and workspaces look like. Bathrooms are relatively easy to clean. Kitchens are not. In fact, if you see the chef sitting unshaven at the bar with a dirty apron on, one finger halfway up his nose, you can assume he's not handling your food any better behind closed doors. Your waiter looks like he just woke up under a bridge. If management allows him to wander out on the floor looking like that, God knows what they're doing to your shrimp. Beef parmentier, shepherd's pie, chili special, sounds like leftovers to me. How about swordfish? I like it fine, but my seafood purveyor, when he goes out to dinner, won't eat it. He's seen too many of those 3-foot-long parasitic worms that riddle the fish's flesh. You see a few of these babies, and we all do, and you won't be tucking in a swordfish anytime soon. Chilean sea bass? Trendy. Expensive. More than likely frozen. This came as a surprise to me when I visited the market recently. Apparently, the great majority of the stuff arrives frozen solid, still on the bone. In fact, as I said earlier, the whole Fulton Street market is not an inspiring sight. Fish is left to sit, uniced, in leaking crates in the middle of August, right out in the open. What isn't bought early is sold for cheap later. At 7 a.m., the Korean and Chinese buyers, who've been sitting in local bars waiting for the market to be near closing, swoop down on the overextended fishmonger and buy up what's left at rock-bottom prices. The next folks to arrive will be the cat food people. Think about that when you see the discount sushi sign. Saving for well done is a time-honored tradition dating back to cuisine's earliest days. Meat and fish cost money. Every piece of cut, fabricated food must, ideally, be sold for 3 or even 4 times its cost in order for the chef to make his food cost percent. So what happens when the chef finds a tough, slightly skanky, end cut of sirloin that's been pushed repeatedly to the back of the pile? He can throw it out, but that's a total loss, representing a threefold loss of what it cost him per pound. He can feed it to the family, which is the same as throwing it out. Or he can save for well done. Serve it to some rube who prefers to eat his meat or fish incinerated into a flavorless, leathery hunk of carbon, who won't be able to tell if what he's eating is food or flotsam. Ordinarily, a proud chef would hate this customer, hold him in contempt for destroying his fine food. But not in this case. The dumb bastard is paying for the privilege of eating his garbage. What's not to like? Vegetarians and their Hezbollah-like splinter faction, the vegans, are a persistent irritant to any chef worth a damn. To me, life without veal stock, pork fat, sausage, organ meat, demi-glace, or even stinky cheese is a life not worth living. Vegetarians are the enemy of everything good and decent in the human spirit, an affront to all I stand for, the pure enjoyment of food. The body, these waterheads imagine, is a temple that should not be polluted by animal protein. It's healthier, they insist, though every vegetarian waiter I've ever worked with is brought down by any rumor of a cold. Oh, I'll accommodate them. I'll rummage around for something to feed them for a vegetarian plate, if called on to do so. $14 for a few slices of grilled eggplant and zucchini suits my food cost fine. But let me tell you a story. A few years back, at a swinging singles joint on Columbus Avenue, we had the misfortune to employ a sensitive young man as a waiter. In addition to a wide and varied social life involving numerous unsafe sexual practices, was something of a jailhouse lawyer. After he was fired for incompetence, he took it on himself to sue the restaurant, claiming that his gastrointestinal problem, caused apparently by amoebas, was a result of his work there. Management took this litigation seriously enough to engage the services of an epidemiologist, who obtained stool samples from every employee. The results, which I was privy to, were enlightening to say the least. The waiter's strain of amoebas, it was concluded, was common to persons of his lifestyle and to many others. What was interesting were the results of our Mexican and South American prep cooks. These guys were teeming with numerous varieties of critters, none of which in their cases caused illness or discomfort. It was explained that the results in our restaurant were no different from results at any other restaurant, and that particularly amongst my recently arrived Latino brethren, this sort of thing is normal, that their systems are used to it, and it causes them no difficulties at all. Amoebas, however, are transferred most easily through the handling of raw, uncooked vegetables, particularly during the washing of salad greens and leafy produce. So think about that next time you want to exchange deep tongue kisses with a vegetarian. I'm not even going to talk about blood. Let's just say we cut ourselves a lot in the kitchen and leave it at that. Pigs are filthy animals, say some, when explaining why they deny themselves the delights of pork. Maybe they should visit a chicken ranch. America's favorite menu item is also the most likely to make you ill. Commercially available chickens, for the most part, we're not talking about kosher and expensive free-range birds, are loaded with salmonella. Chickens are dirty. They eat their own feces, are kept packed close together like in a rush-hour subway, and when handled in a restaurant situation are most likely to infect other foods or cross-contaminate them. And chicken is boring. Chefs see it as a menu item for people who don't know what they want to eat. Shrimp? All right, if it looks fresh, smells fresh, and the restaurant is busy, guaranteeing turnover of product on a regular basis. But shrimp toast? I'll pass. I walk into a restaurant with a mostly empty dining room and an unhappy-looking owner staring out the window. I'm not ordering shrimp. This principle applies to anything on a menu, actually, especially something esoteric and adventurous like, say, bouillabaisse. If a restaurant is known for steak and doesn't seem to be doing much business, how long do you think those few orders of clams and mussels and lobster and fish have been sitting in the refrigerator waiting for someone like you to order it? The key is rotation. If the restaurant is busy and you see bouillabaisse flying out the kitchen doors every few minutes, then it's probably a good bet. but a big and varied menu in a slow, half-empty place. Those less popular items like broiled mackerel and calf's liver are kept festering in a dark corner of the region because they look good on the menu. You might not actually want to eat them. Look at your waiter's face. He knows. It's another reason to be polite to your waiter. He could save your life with a raised eyebrow or a sigh. If he likes you, maybe he'll stop you from ordering a piece of fish he knows is going to hurt you. On the other hand, maybe the chef has ordered him, under pain of death, to move that codfish before it begins to really reek. Observe the body language and take note. Watchwords for fine dining, Tuesday through Saturday. Busy. Turnover. Rotation. Tuesdays and Thursdays are the best nights to order fish in New York. The food that comes in Tuesday is fresh, the station prep is new, and the chef is well-rested after a Sunday or a Monday off. It's the real start of the new week, when you've got the goodwill of the kitchen on your side. Fridays and Saturdays, the food is fresh, but it's busy, so the chef and cooks can't pay as much attention to your food as they and you might like. And weekend diners are universally viewed with suspicion, even contempt, by both cooks and waiters alike. They're the slackjaws, the rubes, the out-of-towners, the well-done eating, under-tipping, bridge-and-tunnel pre-theater hordes, in to see Cats or Les Mis and never to return. Weekday diners, on the other hand, are the home team, potential regulars whom all concerned want to make happy. Rested and ready after a day off, the chef is going to put his best foot forward on Tuesday. He's got his best quality product coming in, and he's had a day or two to think of creative things to do with it. He wants you to be happy on Tuesday night. On Saturday, he's thinking more about turning over tables and getting through the rush. If the restaurant is clean, the cooks and waiters well-groomed, the dining room busy, everyone seems to actually care about what they're doing, not just trying to pick up a few extra bucks between headshots and auditions for Days of Our Lives, chances are you're in for a decent meal. The owner, chef, and a bored-looking waiter sitting at a front table chatting about soccer scores, plumber walking through the dining room with a toilet snake, bad signs. Watch the trucks pull up outside the restaurant delivery entrance in the morning if you're in the neighborhood. Reputable vendors of seafood, meat, and produce? Good sign. If you see sinister, unmarked step vans offloading all three at once, or the big tractor trailers from one of the national outfits, you know the ones, servicing restaurants and institutions for 50 years, just remember what institutions they're talking about. Cafeterias, schools, prisons. Unless you like frozen portion-controlled convenience food. Do all these horrifying assertions frighten you? Should you stop eating out? Wipe yourself down with antiseptic towelettes every time you pass a restaurant? No way. Like I said before, your body is not a temple. It's an amusement park. Enjoy the ride. Sure, it's a play-you-pay sort of an adventure, but you knew that already every time you ever ordered a taco or a dirty water hot dog. If you're willing to risk some slight lower GI distress for one of those Italian sweet sausages at the street fair, or for a slice of pizza you just know has been sitting on the board for an hour or two, why not take a chance on the good stuff? All the great developments of classical cuisine, the first guys to eat sweetbreads, to try unpasteurized Stilton, to discover that snails actually tasted good with enough garlic butter. These were daredevils, innovators, and desperados. I don't know who figured out that if you crammed rich food into a goose long enough for its liver to balloon up to more than its normal body weight, you'd get something as good as foie gras. I believe it was those kooky Romans, but I'm very grateful for their efforts. Popping raw fish into your face, especially in pre-refrigeration days, might have seemed like sheer madness to some, but it turned out to be a pretty good idea. They say that Rasputin used to eat a little arsenic with breakfast every day, building up resistance for the day that an enemy might poison him, and that sounds like good sense to me. Judging from accounts of his death, the mad monk wasn't fazed at all by this stuff. It took repeated beatings, a couple of bullets, and a long fall off a bridge into a frozen river to finish the job. Perhaps we, as serious diners, should emulate his example. We are, after all, citizens of the world, a world filled with bacteria, some friendly, some not so friendly. Do we really want to travel in hermetically sealed Pope-mobiles through the rural provinces of France, Mexico, and the Far East, eating only in Hard Rock cafes and McDonald's? Or do we want to eat without fear? Tearing into the local stew, the humble taqueria's mystery meat, the sincerely offered gift of a lightly grilled fish head. I know what I want. I want it all. I want to try everything once. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, Signor Tamale Stand Owner, Sushi Chef-san, Monsieur Buckethead. What's that feathered game bird hanging on the porch getting riper by the day, the body nearly ready to drop off? I want some. I have no wish to die. Nor do I have some unhealthy fondness for dysentery. If I know you're storing your squid at room temperature next to a cat box, I'll get my squid down the street, thank you very much. I will continue to do my seafood eating on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, because I know better, because I can wait. But if I have one chance at a full-blown dinner of blowfish gizzard, even if I have not been properly introduced to the chef, and I'm in a strange, far eastern city, and my plane leaves tomorrow, I'm going for it. You only go around once. How to cook like the pros. Unless you're one of us already, you'll probably never cook like a professional. And that's okay. On my day off, I rarely want to eat restaurant food unless I'm looking for new ideas or recipes to steal. What I want to eat is home cooking. Somebody's, anybody's, mother's or grandmother's food. A simple pasta pomodoro made with love, a clumsily thrown together tuna casserole, roast beef with Yorkshire pudding, all of this is pure exotica to me, even when I've been neck deep all day in filet mignon and herb-infused oils, and all the bits of business we do to distinguish restaurant food from what you get at home. My mother-in-law would always apologize before serving dinner when I was in attendance, saying, "This must seem pretty ordinary for a chef." She had no idea how magical, how reassuring, how pleasurable her simple meatloaf was for me, what a delight even lumpy mashed potatoes were, being, as they were, blessedly devoid of truffles or truffle oil. But you don't want to know this. What you'd like to know is how to make your next dinner party look as though you've got the Trois Gros family chained to the stove in your home kitchen. Maybe you're curious about the tricks, the techniques, the few simple tools that can make your plates look as if they've been prepared, assembled, and garnished by cold-blooded professionals. Let's talk about tools first. What do we have in our kitchens that you probably don't? The joke is that many of our stock items, herb oils, crushed spices, chiffonaded parsley, pureed starches and veggies, are often made with home model equipment just like yours. I may have a 25-quart professional Hobart mixer and an ultra-large robot coop, but chances are I used a home blender to make that lovely roast red pepper coulis dotted with bright green basil oil drizzled around your plate. So what do you absolutely need? You need, for God's sake, a decent chef's knife. No con foisted on the general public is so atrocious, so wrong-headed, or so widely believed as the one that tells you you need a full set of specialized cutlery in various sizes. I wish sometimes I could go through the kitchens of amateur cooks everywhere, just throwing knives out from their drawers, all those medium-sized utility knives, those useless serrated things you see advertised on TV, all that hard-to-sharpen stainless steel garbage, those ineptly designed slicers. Not one of the damn things could cut a tomato. Please believe me, here's all you will ever need in the knife department. One good chef's knife, as large as is comfortable for your hand. Brand name? Okay. Most talented amateurs get a boner buying one of the old-school professional high-carbon stainless knives from Germany or Austria, like a Henkel or a Wusthof, and those are fine knives, if heavy. High-carbon makes them slightly easier to sharpen, and stainless keeps them from getting stained and corroded. They look awfully good in the knife case at the store, too, and you send a message to your guests when flashing a $100 hunk of Solingen steel that you take your cooking seriously. But do you really need something so heavy, so expensive, so difficult to maintain, which you probably won't? Unless you are really and truly going to spend 15 minutes every couple of days working that blade on an oiled carborundum stone, followed by a careful honing on a diamond steel, I'd forego the Germans. Most of the professionals I know have for years been retiring their Wusthofs and replacing them with the lightweight, easy-to-sharpen, and relatively inexpensive vanadium steel global knives, a very good Japanese product which has, in addition to its many other fine qualities, the added attraction of looking really cool. Global makes a lot of knives in different sizes, so what do you need? One chef's knife. This should cut just about anything you might work with, from a shallot to a watermelon, an onion to a sirloin strip. Like a pro, you should use the tip of the knife for the small stuff and the area nearer the heel for the larger. This isn't difficult. Buy a few rutabagas or onions. They're cheap, and practice on them. Nothing will set you apart from the herd quicker than the ability to handle a chef's knife properly. If you need instruction on how to handle a knife without lopping off a finger, I recommend Jacques Pepin's La Technique. Okay, there are a couple of other knives you might find useful. I carry a flexible boning knife, also made by the fine folks at Global, because I can fillet the occasional fish, and because with the same knife I can butcher whole tenderloins, bone out legs of lamb, French cut racks of veal, and trim meat. If your butcher is doing all the work for you, you can probably live without one. A paring knife comes in handy once in a while if you find yourself tourneying vegetables, fluting mushrooms, and doing the kind of microsurgery that my old pal Dimitri used to excel at. But how often do you do that? A genuinely useful blade, however, and one that is increasingly popular with my cronies in the field, is what's called an offset serrated knife. It's basically a serrated knife set into an ergonomic handle. It looks like a Z that's been pulled out and elongated. This is a truly cool item, which, once used, becomes indispensable. As the handle is not flush with the blade, but raised away from the cutting surface, you can use it not only for your traditional serrated blade needs, like slicing bread, thick skin.